The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, I'm here. I'm coming with you. And we're all going to be coming with you. This is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, every week at this time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm doing this show as an extension of the blog I write every day called NewsDissector.com. You can follow my writing there or follow me on Twitter or Facebook. I'm attempting to offer a counter-narrative to the news, to report on what's not being reported. If you want to join us on the show, there's a toll-free number, 888-874-4888. And today we're talking about some very important issues that are tied to this whole economic crisis and the government dominated as it is, at least in the Congress, by Republicans who want to destroy the government. They're there basically as servants of the government, but their actual policies are to cut the government to the bone and to lay off as many people as possible in the process, even as they claim to be job creators or wanting to create jobs. So we're going to be talking today about two aspects of this whole crisis. We're going to be talking about the Occupy Wall Street protests. David DeGraw, who is an editor of AmpedStatus.com, who's one of the people who called for the occupation of Wall Street, who's one of the people who's written analysis about how American workers and American people are being attacked by the economic elite in this country who are stealing their homes, stealing their wealth, and stealing their hope. And David will be on with us from his secret location in Long Island in the second half of the show to talk about Occupy Wall Street, to tell us what's really going on there. He's very knowledgeable about it. He's been part of all the discussions. This weekend there's going to be a big debate there about what the future of it all is, and David will be part of that debate, and he will be sharing with us some of the history and background to the Occupy Wall Street protests, as well as his analysis of the financial crisis. You'll notice yesterday in the New York Times there was an article saying that a market crash can be expected. The people in power economically are totally panicked, if you will, about what's going to happen now. They don't have any answers, really. The European debt crisis, they say it's going to take a long time to solve. Well, that assumes it can be solved, which I don't particularly buy necessarily. So we have a situation where the word crash is out there in the New York Times. Today, George Soros, writing in the Financial Times of England, said how to avoid a depression. And he laid out an analysis about avoiding a depression, which suggests, of course, that he believes that a depression is very likely. So all this talk of recovery, all this talk of we're bouncing back, we're Americans, we're gonna make it, blah, 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 forget it. This situation is extremely serious, it's structural, it's systemic, and it affects all of us. And it particularly affects the people on the front lines of it all, particularly in this case, America's postal workers, who are facing massive cutbacks and the closing of post offices. And we're going to talk about that with people in the know, people who have worked for the post office, people who are trying to fight back with the workers of the post office. So all of that is happening. I'm wearing some earphones that seem to be clinking here, so I'm hearing this click, 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 click. I hope it's not too annoying. At any rate, that's what we're going to be talking about today. But we're going to start with some music from a new album by Stefan Saeed. He's an Iraqi-American singer. The album is called Different. Music equal action, it says on the cover. He's been out front on a lot of these struggles for a long, long time. And Stefan Smith. Now he's gone back to his original Arabic name, Saeed. And he has a new album out, which is produced by Hal Wilner, who's a very well-known music producer. And one of the things he did was a remake of the song sung by Egyptians in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, a kind of an Egyptian freedom song. And we're going to launch the program today with that song by Stefan Saeed.
Thank you. أحب عشت الحرية زيت يونس بين الأقصار مدى الحبايب حواليا كل بلاد عندي أوطان مطرح ميت
ستيفن سعيد bringing us the song that really inspired those Egyptian activists who took over Tahrir Square and forced their president out of office, who have created or helped perpetuate or promote, rather, the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia, a heroic struggle that we all saw on television, on Al Jazeera, and in many other TV outlets. And so it's a good musical note to begin our discussion of what's happening now. Can there be resistance? Can American workers stand up as they have so often in the past to defend their jobs and defend their institutions? Because right now they are really being targeted. And here to discuss this with us is Chuck Slatkin. Chuck, why don't you introduce yourself and your colleague, and then we can get started here.
Okay, my name is Chuck Slatkin. I'm the legislative and political director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union, which is the largest local in the American Postal Workers Union, and I'm here with my colleague Joanne Flagler, who's the coordinating vice president and probably one of the best shop stewards in the nation in terms of what she does on behalf of our membership.
Well, you know, the postal workers, you know, didn't ask for this fight, didn't want this fight, but it's been foisted on them because two things are happening. One, a threat to lay off as many, 20% or 30% of the postal workers, and then to close post offices. I just received yesterday a survey from the post office asking me about my experience with post offices, about a new Port Authority station here, and basically this is an effort basically to get political support, public support for closing post offices. They have what they call the district discontinuance coordinator. How's that for a term? Who is there to basically expedite the shutting down of post offices. So tell us a little bit about the origins of this crisis, because most people don't know about, you know, we all assume, well, the internet is here, people are using email, nobody uses the post office anymore, so it's got to be shut down. True, false, what?
Well, it's a manufactured crisis. It's been a plan that's been in effect for a number of years, and they've really done a pretty good job of getting out the big lie to the American people. Most people think, well, the internet's here, email. Of course, there's no need for a postal service like there once was. But the fact of the matter is that 2006 was the biggest year.
Well, let's just answer that for a second. People, in fact, have been using the post office more than ever, despite email. There was a surge, if you will, in post office use. And the alternative is FedEx or UPS, which is a lot more expensive.
Well, that is indeed the case. More people have used the post office. The volume in 2006 was the highest volume of mail handled in the 236-year history of the post office. And that was followed by 2005 and 2007, well into the internet era. So yes, it has had an impact on first-class mail. There are fewer people writing letters to grandma, but every one of the people are getting their Netflix through the postal service.
You never write anymore, Chuck. Tell us a little bit about your experience. When did you join the post office, and what's your career been like there?
I became a career employee in the postal service, starting at Church Street Station in 1969. I started as a clerk, a level 5 clerk, and I've been employed ever since. Myself and along with Chuck too, we were the first, when they had the strike in 1970, we were part of that strike. Prior to that, we had no collective bargaining power, and because of the strike and because of the history of the union, we was able to attain, and we hope to retain our collective bargaining power with the Postal Service.
Well, you mentioned the Church Street Station, and it brought back a certain memory that can I share briefly? It's a wild one. I was producing a series on South Africa called South Africa Now, and we were always struggling for money. We had our offices up on Broome Street, and we were on West Broadway. And so we went to the Carnegie Corporation, a foundation in New York. They agreed to give us some money, which we desperately needed. And the money, this was Christmas time, I forget what year, but it was like we needed that check and we needed it now. And then we the check didn't come day after day. No check, no check, no check. Finally, we called them and said, "You said you sent it. Where did you send it?" Mm-hmm. They said, "Well, we sent it to 361 Broadway. And we say, "Excuse us, we're at West Broadway. That's another street in New York." Well, how did we know? I guess you just have to wait a couple of weeks for the check to come back, and then, we can't wait. Our whole series is at risk if we wait. So we immediately hung up. We raced down to 361 Broadway, this giant building, and we didn't know what to do. So we found a guy in the basement. Okay, he was a kind of cleaning up, an African guy. And we told him, we have this program, South Africa. Now he says, "I love that program. I love that show. How can I help you?" So he takes us by the hand, and we go to every office in 361 Broadway that might have any relevance to this. And, finally we find somebody. It's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We find somebody. He says, "Yeah, we did find a letter. We sent it back to the post office." So we went, "You sent it back? This is the check we desperately need. It's 5 o'clock. We raced out. Where's the nearest post office? Church Street Station. We raced there. We went to the dead letter office in that, and they had it. and it saved our show. So thanks to the post office being there, and thanks to the, information we got, and unfortunately because of the stupidity of whoever it was at the foundation who didn't know the difference between West Broadway and Broadway, nevertheless, we did get that check, and it's just reminded me of this particular little incident. So, Chuck, a lot of this has to do with money, big, big money, that the post office is basically supposedly broke. The post office has no money. The post office has to be closed. It has to be shut down. It's a disaster, true, but people all have to kind of pull their belts in and basically sacrifice. True? What is the truth?
Well, it's untrue in the sense that it's a manufactured crisis. The Postal Service would be doing fine if it wasn't for mandates, financial mandates that were put upon it by the Congress in 2006, the lame duck Republican Congress. Their last act was to create this legislation which requires the Postal Service to, I'll say it slowly because it's even hard for me to believe at this point.
And this happened at midnight. They voted at midnight, okay? The Senate voted at 4 in the morning. Nobody knew about this. Go ahead.
And it was, a voice vote. I mean, eventually they had to say who voted which way. But so get this. The Postal Service would be required to fully pre-fund future retirees' health benefits for the next 75 years, and they would have to do it within a 10-year window. That means the Postal Service, each September 30th, and today's the day, has to write a check from their operating funds for the U.S. Treasury for $5.5 billion. So the Postal Service is $5.5 billion in the hole before they sell one stamp or money order. And this created a tremendous burden on the Postal Service that it could have absorbed when the economy was going full blast. When there was a setback in the economy in 2008, the crisis was created. But as insane as this sounds, it was even something even greater, that for decades the Postal Service has overpaid because they were required to into the employee retirement funds, and two recent audits in the last 2 years came up with the figure that they had overpaid between $50 and $75 billion. So rather than the Postal Service being a drain on the government, on taxpayers, it's the opposite way around. The Postal Service gets no money from the government to operate. It's self-sufficient based on the services that it sells.
So here you have a post office that's actually doing well, and yet it's being decimated by these legislative mandates, which make it impossible, really, to operate. And, you know, on top of that, it seems as if the post office was sort of privatized and run by people who are getting CEO-type salaries.
Well, that wasn't always the case. After the strike that Joanne talked about, and to be full disclosure, I didn't come into the Postal Service till after the strike, they were operating as an agency of the government, and the Postmaster General was getting a decent salary. They then created all kinds of performance bonuses. I won't go down that road now because it'll take us away from the main focus. But the main focus is that the Postal Service would be acting fine if they didn't have these burdens. The question is why. And part of the reason is there are close to 600,000 postal workers still working in the Postal Service who are making a living wage, have benefits, health care, and retirement package. The Postal Service is the second biggest employer in the United States behind Walmart. The difference is that Walmart workers are not unionized and postal workers are. And there are forces in this country who want to privatize because they see the volume of business that the Postal Service does and the need that exists for it to be there. And they say, why are we giving all this money to working people where if we can just break the unions and privatize, that money can go to the people who they believe need it the most, the corporate and the rich. This is another case where working people and poor people are being asked to subsidize the rich by giving up the Postal Service, which actually has existed longer than the Constitution.
You know, longer than the Constitution, wow. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, it seems like to me, you know, is that the Postal Office was sort of an equal opportunity employer, that the Post Office has a very diverse employee mix, that the Post Office has, you know, people of color, people who couldn't get necessarily jobs in the private economy, but got them in the Post Office because the government was mandated to pursue equal employment practices. Is that true? I mean, in other words, closing the post office is going to bring hardship to the people who are the least able to find new jobs in this economy.
Yes, the post office is a makeup of all people of all different ethnic backgrounds and races. They took the civil service test, they passed the test, and they've been employed with we have a contract, and which has a no layoff clause, and we were protected by that contract. So yes, there are people of all backgrounds that work in the post office today, and with those positions and the jobs that we have, and we're protected by the contract, they're able to provide for their family and their family members, send their children to college, and they want work to retire one day, to be able to live peacefully for the rest of their lives.
Think of the social consequences here, because I've been told that one half of all black men in New York City are out of work. Okay, that's a depression in itself. That's not only depressing, it's an outrage, okay? And now the people who in the post office, who are working people, are facing, you know, joblessness at a time when the president and supposedly the Republicans even are talking about job creation. We're seeing here a threatened job destruction. Is that upsetting to you? Does that upset the workers in the post office?
Each and every day on the work floor, we hear the echoing of the people when they hear these issues, these bills are being passed, introduced by various Republicans about elimination of our jobs, elimination of our benefits. It's very scary.
And Chuck, what about all this? I mean, are people fighting back? Are the postal workers fighting back? I understand you had an action this past week.
Right. On Tuesday, we had the Save the Postal Service rallies in every congressional district in the country. Actually, there were 494 simultaneous rallies in congressional offices because they were on recess. They were home. And we were there to thank the people who were with us, who signed on to the bill that we're supporting, that we feel is a very simple solution to the financial crisis of the Postal Service, the manufactured one, so maybe the Congress can go on and take care of some of the real crises. and it was successful. At this point, we need anybody who's listening to contact their congressional representative and ask them to sign on as co-sponsors to H.R. 1351, or thank them if they have. And to
1351.
Ask them, yeah, 1351, which basically is no cost to the taxpayers, and it just says we'll take the money from the overpayment into the retirement pensions and apply that to the future obligation that was created for health care for people who haven't even been born yet, let alone hired by the Postal Service, and then we can move on. Right now we have 216 co-sponsors, and with two more we would have the majority, and we could take action to force it to the floor.
Do you think that you'll get those two other votes?
Well, actually, part of what took place at the rallies is two Republicans, one Tea Party Republican, House Member Reed, told the people in front of their rallies that they were going to sign on. So it's not official now. We should have 218 by the time they get back in.
So there is a kind of a short-term, you know, a basic fix here that could actually put this immediate crisis to bed. But it seems like it's an ongoing issue, an ongoing problem. Haven't we seen privatization? I grew up at the time the post office was, you know, a government agency, and then suddenly FedEx came along, UPS came along, and with a lot of government support and subsidies. I mean, they were carrying mail. They were doing a lot of services for the government. Isn't that true?
Well, yes. Well, they're private corporations who have an interest in pleasing their stockholders, and those stockholders donate money to congressional candidates, and a lot of the cream, the most profitable aspects of the Postal Service, were legislated to be able to use by, you know, private companies, because the Postal Service right now is an agency. It's not quite, you know, privatized, and it's not quite a post office department as it used to be, but it's functioning quite well, and with the money that would be credited to it, which it's already overpaid, not only could it pay off the future obligations, it could pay down whatever debt it has, and it could use the balance, which would be about $20 billion, to modernize and expand the services. The infrastructure is there. All the post offices, the trucks, the employees, the postal service could really grow to even be a greater service to the American people.
So there you have it, you know, a sort of a kind of a conundrum that's not really fully explained in the media. People think that, you know, the postal workers are greedy, the postal workers are getting away with something, they're getting a better deal. And in a time when we have so much unemployment, there's resentment that develops. There's, you know, people who are looking at other workers and say, oh, they have it better than us, so what's their, you know, scam? What are they doing? And as a result, we don't have the kind of solidarity we need, the kind of support that we need from other unions and just customers of the post office who stand on those lines, who've met these postal workers, who know them and know how hard they work, to be able to support the struggle of the postal workers. I mean, to me, I've been of late personally fulfilling orders for my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and my book The Crime of Our Time, and, you know, I'm online at the post office almost every day as long as those orders keep coming in at Plunder, The Crime of Our Time.com, and I, you know, I'm there, and I know some of them by name now. They know me. You know, I'm very impressed with their dedication and the efficiency of their operations. You know, it gets a little testy at Christmas time. It's a little overcrowded, but people use the Postal Service, and they care about it. And if it wasn't there, all of our costs will go up dramatically, it seems to me. And that's why we have a stake in trying to preserve the Postal Service, preserve the rights of these workers, and honor them for their service. You know, everybody's talking about, we honor you for your service if you're in wars. How about honoring these people for their service who stand behind, you know, on those lines every day, helping people with their needs to get, you know, important packages and important things out to their families and to, you know, pay bills and everything else. So the Postal Service, to me, I take this personally. I mean, I'm upset by this. That's why I had you on. It's not just another subject to me. This is something that really should matter to us. And, you know, how many public services have we seen getting, you know, destroyed? We need jobs. Let's keep the people who have jobs in their jobs instead of destroying their jobs. That's my little editorial of the day. Final comment from you and then from Chuck about how people can help.
People can help by contacting their congressional leaders and ask them to support H.R. Bill 1351. Email them, write letters, and encourage them to support H.R. 1351.
We want them to write letters now, don't we, to keep the volume of business at the post office up. Yes, Chuck, final thoughts.
Well, I think what you were talking about is correct, and the fact that people here, you know, we are the 99%. You know, postal workers, people working in non-union places, people who are looking for jobs. There's a time now where it's important for us to come together, and I think we have to pay attention to what's happening at Occupy Wall Street, where maybe the vanguard of a new movement, a workers' movement, is forming as we speak.
And many of those folks came up to support your meeting, I think, with Congressman Nadler here on the west side, the upper left side of Manhattan.
Yeah, they there was about 100, over 100 people from Occupy Wall Street. A march up to join the rally at Congressman Nadler's office under the threat of arrest. The post office, the police told them that if they continued to march, they would be arrested, and they dispersed and reformed in front of Nadler's office. So that kind of unity of all people working together is what we need now.
You know, we see that, you know, the police also have a union. Police ought to respect people who are fighting for better conditions for people. You know, John Stewart did a tremendous piece yesterday on, you know, police officer Anthony Bologna, who he called Tony Bologna, who's been spraying people with pepper gas. You know, this is an outrage in the city of New York, this type of abuse, and I hope it's also brought under control by our mayor when he's not in Bermuda. He can basically try to maybe help preserve, you know, law and order and allow people their constitutional rights to protest and to voice their opinions. And I think the postal workers are doing that now. Your efforts are really important, heroic even, in my opinion, because I'm sure people are very demoralized. They're very upset. They're very uncertain about their futures. They have families. They have kids in college. This is not an abstraction. It's not an issue that's sort of, you know, we can put up on the wall and say, yeah, we'll get to that in the future. We have to get to it right now. So thanks very much for coming on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're going to segue into another song from Stefan Said from his new album, Different.
About a bunch of grown men with toys to learn how to lead the hard way. The more things change, they stay the same. Since Jesus walked the earth, still playing the same game. Everybody's waiting to move on.
Advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stocks, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking to AAA. Grandpa owes his 401k.
Plunder, plunder, plunder. That's the theme song of my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. Polarity One is the person who actually created the songs that go along with it. He also worked on my film, In Debt We Trust. And so we're trying to offer some music. We're also hoping that perhaps some of the activists at Occupy Wall Street will be interested in, helping us show this film and get it out there, because we have a big education job to do. We're having a screening very soon. Kat, can you just tell us about the screening and when it is and where it is, of people who are interested to come to see the film, Plunder?
Sure. We're going to be showing it October 22nd, which is a Saturday, at 6 p.m. at In Studios, which is at 56 Walker Street here in New York City. It's right off of Canal. And
it's off of Broadway, actually. It's in Tribeca, INN Studios.
Right.
And please, please come to it if you can, or tell people about it. We're now producing out of a paper bag the actual flyer that's been distributed at Occupy Wall Street by Kat.
I handed out 50 flyers the other day.
50 flyers.
I have to make more flyers.
And one of the people who you handed the flyer to, Mark Levin, the well-known filmmaker, I ran into him in front of my house later that evening. He said, "Yeah, I was given a flyer for your movie. It's all over Occupy Wall Street."
Good.
So there you go. So it has had some impact. You may remember Mark was on our program talking about his film about the Triangle Fire that he did with Daphne Pinkerson. And so, he was very impressed to see it out there. And, this is something, we need tools to do more education about this issue. David DeGraw is joining us. He's the editor of AmpStatus.com. But David has been really one of the people who's really had the vision to call for this occupation, one of the people who has been talking about the 99%ers, most of America, who are being basically attacked by 1% of the economic elite. David was down on the occupation in Liberty Park on Liberty Street and Broadway, Zuccotti Park, the other day, and we talked, and I invited him on the program to give us some perspective, because apparently this weekend there's going to be a discussion at the park site, at the encampment site, about the future of this movement. So, David, tell us, bring us up to date on what's happening, because you played a very important role in all of this, and I want to acknowledge it.
Thanks for having me on, Danny. It's tough to make time to breathe these days with everything that's going on. It's amazing how this movement has taken off. But what I do want to say at first, though, is to give your listeners a little history lesson of, the relationship you and I have had. This is why I'm making time out to be on your show, because, I have a lot of respect for all the work you've done. The first time Danny and I met was in 2000, the summer of 2000, when I was trying to organize a protest against media companies through Midtown. And from that point on, Danny and I have really worked together, for the past 11 years. Danny, your work revealing the economic crisis before it even happened, when you made In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst, was really just a seminal work. I worked on that with you, and I remember when people were dismissing the film as alarmist and saying that, what are you talking about? The economy's doing fine. And, you exposed all that foreclosure fraud and subprime lending. Even though we're busy and we can hardly breathe, and interview requests are coming out of everywhere, you have to come on this show and pay some respect to one of the guys who really helped launch this as well, you yourself, Danny.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that, David. I appreciate it. I certainly don't hear too much of that, but I'm persisting anyway. I've written three books and made two films about this financial crisis and trying to get it out. The problem is, of course, the financial crisis hit us, too. We were forced to close our office. We, are trying to operate on a guerrilla basis with small screenings and, promoting.
It's been brutal, Danny. you and I working together in independent media and, you know, losing funding and the economic crisis really did hit us hard. You know, personally, you know, I had to move my family three times in the past 3 years to downsize and, you know, so we could keep ends meeting and bills paid, you know. I mean, I used to live right down the road from Liberty Park. That's, you know, how I knew about Liberty Park and how we came to choosing that place as a strategic point. But, you know, I had to move out of the city 3 years ago because I've been working in independent media and there's just no funding.
Well, you know, I think that's important for people to recognize that a lot of the people involved in this struggle are making a personal sacrifice to do it. You know, these are people who are also been hard hit by this economic crisis. They're not just, you know, people with time on their hands have nothing better to do, you know, but to hang out. They're really serious and they're very motivated. I was very impressed by a lot of the people down there who are, you know, really hard working, are trying to create a sense of a community, leaderless though it may be, you know, and let everyone have a say, let everyone speak, sort of democracy in action. This is what democracy looks like. People chant, well, it is, or it should be.
Let's right, put Danny, it- everyone down there has, you know, their own incredible story of, you know, just fighting back against their own personal economic oppression and that of their families. I mean, the people down there, you will hear so many stories of people who have been, you know, driven into poverty because of health care issues. You know, obviously there's many down there who are suffering a massive student debt, who have degrees and they can't find jobs in what they've been trained for. So everyone really does have their own story, and this really is decentralized in the pure essence of it, because it is individuals fighting back against their own financial oppression, and it's the same thing we've seen throughout the Middle East, Northern Africa, and Europe.
Yeah, I mean, this is very important to recognize that, you know, there is a level of seriousness here. It looks like a lot of fun. People who come from the outside, some journalists who tend to put it down. You know, one website called it a menagerie. You know, another, the New York Times sort of made fun of it. The Wall Street Journal, you know, tagged their story by saying, well, you know, the one redeeming quality is they like pizza. You know, they have pizza
right,
delivered.
Well.
You know, so they don't get it really. And don't want to get it, in fact want to destroy it, but it seems...
Well, Danny, just real quick, this is one of the things that we touched on when we were talking down at Liberty Park. You know, the corporate media, a lot of people down, you know, they come down there and they try and look for, you know, the oddest looking person, or, you know, find someone who they could tell is a little confused and doesn't express themselves well, and they target those people. And this is one of the things that upsets me about the movement, because I believe that, you know, everyone there should be able to tell their story however they want to tell it. But when the corporate media comes down and they look for the weakest link, it in turn makes the whole movement look bad. And that's something we're battling against right now. So...
Catherine has been down there more than I have. What's your sense of the community there?
I find those people to be extremely organized. I mean, they have like a media section. They hold meetings like at least two times a day. I mean, they have a kitchen area. They clean up every day. I see them sweeping like every night. And, you know, they're very respectful. They have a code of conduct. I mean, I'm drawn to being there because I feel that when I'm there, you know, these people, like, they treat, you know, they want to make the world that they want to live in, and they're creating it in this small area.
And it's very diverse also in terms of people. But at the same time, David,
just before we move on, yeah. You know, she makes an excellent point there. And I think that the New York City General Assembly, you know, a group of activists that grew out of the Bloombergville two-week occupation that were protesting budget cuts, that group has been, you know, really helping to establish the community that she's talking about, and, you know, to have the meetings happen. You know, they consider themselves to be facilitators, not, you know, leaders. But they've been doing an excellent job of, you know, making sure the trains run on time down there.
But, you know, at the same time, maybe this is my age showing or my, you know, fears coming out. But, you know, there are people who have been sort of leading on this issue. You're one of them. I'd like to think I'm one of them also, who've been there, you know, in rain and sunshine, trying to push this forward. And I'm a little worried about this sort of imploding, you know, kind of good intentions, great feelings, good vibes, but no leadership at all in terms of articulating a program for change. Now, you've reported that there's going to be a discussion this weekend about the future of all this. What's that going to be about?
Right. Well, starting tonight, people will be making proposals for possible demands and the agenda and platform for moving forward. Yeah, it's going to be a very... And then through the weekend, people are going to vote on those, and through a direct democracy consensus, we'll see what comes out of that as far as demands and an agenda moving forward. But, yeah, it's a very pivotal moment, and as you say, I share a lot of those fears that you've been mentioning. It's going to be a difficult weekend to get through. We'll see what happens.
Well, you know, at the same time, I think that when I was down there the other day, I didn't get to go to it. There was a teach-in on the economy. I don't know who was offering it. I think Professor Wolf from the New School, or his son Max. I'm not sure who was actually leading it. But it does seem that there needs to be more internal education about what's going on so that the movement there can't be sort of ridiculed, if you will, by the media as a bunch of know-nothings. You know, focus not just on, you know, the Fed is bad, but also how this whole crisis happened and why it's continuing, because we may be just at the beginning of a further crash. I mean, the New York Times is projecting a crash. George Soros is talking about a depression. I mean, this is so-called people who are experts.
Wait, Danny, on that issue, of course we're headed for a crash. We've always known this. I mean, you know, it's tough to sum everything up, but look, they built a derivative Ponzi scheme that was 10 times the size of the entire global economy, okay? How could that not collapse? I mean, you know, completely, you know, and they're trying to keep it going by bailing out the companies, by their quantitative easing programs, by changing the accounting rules, allowing trillions of dollars of accounting fraud. I mean, you know, they've gotten so corrupt in trying to keep this Ponzi scheme going, but it's just, it's impossible. Of course there's a crash coming.
Well, you know, and of course we should also point out, just as, you know, 80 people were arrested, you know, last Saturday in a march, no Wall Street bankers really have been arrested and sent to jail in terms of, you know, what's happened here. There have been settlements between companies and, you know, and the Justice Department. There have been prosecutions of insider traders who are accused of ripping off other investors. But the people responsible for the crash of the economy and what it's meant for all of us, for the rest of us, for the 99%, those people so far have yet to be prosecuted, yet to be, you know, put before a court, and it's likely they're likely to get off.
Well, that's why I feel that one of the demands, it might not be the initial demand, but one of the demands has to be to prosecute these people through RICO laws. And you certainly know all about that as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm calling for a jail out, not a bailout, you know, exactly. of these people. I mean, this situation is, first of all, you know, very instructive, because it shows us that the people who are supposed to know, who are so smart, the experts, the MBAs, the people who have, you know, worked at these firms for all these years, who are the insiders, don't know anything. You know, they know how to get themselves enriched. They know how to transfer money from your pocket to their pocket. But, you know, as far as really understanding what's going on or how to fix it, they don't have a clue. And that's why even Goldman Sachs is having big cutbacks, and other firms are as well, Bank of America and all the rest of them. These geniuses that have been so admired, you know, on all of these shows, CNBC, you know, Fortune Magazine put, you know, Enron on its cover as one of the greatest companies in America before they basically put them on their cover as one of the biggest crooks in America. But
all right, Danny.
Yeah.
You know, how we got into this situation is something that I call the system of political bribery, you know, through campaign finance, lobbying, and the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street and other major global corporations. The richest one-tenth of 1% of the population has been able to buy the government. And it's not just the United States. It's the same people have done it to Greece, done it to Egypt, Tunisia, you know, Ireland, Italy, all through Europe. I mean, it's the same people who have bought governments through a system of legalized political bribery. And when you do that, all the regulations go away. Everything that is to stop a, you know, too big to fail company from robbing and exploiting national populations goes out the window, and you see the results.
Now, in your analysis, you basically talk about the economic elite in America as declaring war, basically, on the American people. Who is
right.
that elite, and what's the nature of this war, in your view?
Well, I mean, obviously it's more of an ideology of exploitation. I don't think it's like some little dark cabal. There's many entities who, you know, it's mega wealthy. It's a neoliberal aristocracy. You know, the global banks are certainly part of that. It's a Federal Reserve banking system and all their primary dealers, which are Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and so on. But, you know, and then also you have organizations like the Business Roundtable, who are Fortune 500 CEOs, who come together to lobby on all sorts of issues in Congress. You know, people in Congress have said that nothing gets through Congress unless the Business Roundtable signs off on it behind closed doors.
And, of course, and you see, like, Obama is basically a captive or at least an emissary for this whole system.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that Obama is part of the system. You know, from the second he hired, you know, one of his first moves as president was to make Tim Geithner the Treasury Secretary. Tim Geithner has such a long history of economic imperialism, you know, from when he first got out of Princeton and started working for Kissinger Associates, and then moved into the Treasury with Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. And, of course, Obama made Larry Summers his head economic advisor. So, yeah, Obama has been a pivotal member of this banking cartel, if you want to call it that.
David, let's before we forget, let's tell people how they can read your essays and your articles, which are very substantive and very well researched, and how they can sign on to ampstatus.com to get your releases and your updates.
Well, I mean, you just said it right there. Ampstatus.com is where I keep my reports. I also have a personal blog site, which is daviddegraw.org. But the bulk of my work is done on ampstatus.com, ampedstatus.com.
So because you revealed about our relationship, you disclosed this unholy, you know, alliance between the two of us, I can disclose something, too. When I first met David, he was working in rock and roll. He was marketing music. I think he was working
right.
for Sony. He was
Pearl Jam.
He was, you know... Now he's an economics expert without a degree. He didn't go to Harvard, thank goodness. You know, he's actually educated himself about all of this through hard research and investigative journalism. And I think that's really impressive, David. You know, you've taken on this issue and you've informed yourself about it. Now you're trying to inform the rest of us. I really respect that. I really hope to see you again this weekend at Occupy Wall Street, where you're going to be holding forth. I know Gary Knoll is speaking tomorrow night. I may be speaking tonight or tomorrow night. I'm not sure yet. We're going to try to keep this issue alive and bring it to the people. You can certainly read about my film Plunder at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. You can read my blog at newsdissector.com. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. To continue this conversation, the podcast of this program will be available on my website, newsdissector.com. It's also available on iTunes. It'll be available on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com site. So you can share it with others if you find it of interest. We have to close out now because we've been going, and just a few more minutes to go. So I want to thank you, David DeGraw, for being with us. I want to thank Catherine for making her contribution. You have one quick thing you must say. You must say it.
I think this is a really important point that David brought up about, like, the media, they focus in on, like, this one weak link and then use that to discredit the group. But that's exactly, it's the exact opposite. It's like focusing, it's like picking a scab or looking at a blemish.
That's what they're trying to do. Catherine, you have no idea of time. You're wonderful. You have a lot to say, but you don't realize that we're at the end of the program and you can't introduce the whole subject now, but I appreciate what you said. Thank you for listening, everybody. Be in touch with PRN. Be in touch with me. And let's keep it going as best we can. There is a better world possible.